Good morning. Welcome each of you to our service this morning. It's good to see each of you here, and welcome the visitors. Trust we can worship the Lord together and learn from His Word. I greet you this morning in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, whom Peter tells us left us an example, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. What a tremendous example. Off the southeast coast of New Jersey is a barrier island called Long Beach. And in that barrier island, there is an inlet called Barnegat Inlet, and it goes through the barrier island leading to the mainland. And it's very dangerous because of the currents and the shifting shoals and the unpredictable weather. It's so dangerous to navigate that the waters off of the Barnegat Inlet have earned a reputation as the graveyard of the Atlantic. So in 1834, Congress decided to commission a lighthouse at the Barnegat Inlet. Unfortunately, it was a low-cost project. It was hastily erected at Barnegat with the goal of safely guiding ships past the peril and to the harbor. The lighthouse stood less than 50 feet tall, and its foundation was weak, its lamp was very dim, and it didn't flash to distinguish it from other lights. And it seems that the builders took some shortcuts because the structure was soon crumbling. And when storms came, that light failed to cut through the darkness of the storm. And ships lost their way. They ran aground. Lives were lost to the surf, because that beacon did not do what it promised to do. I believe there's a lesson in that light that failed for both mariners and for Christians today. In the workplace, whether we are employers, employees, or customers, as Christians, we are called to be beacons of light and hope. We're called to be living witnesses of Christ's truth and love. We're called to an unshaken honesty, an unshakable honesty, reliability in the strongest storm. But like the lighthouse at Barnegat, if our integrity is compromised or we shade the truth, the consequences from that failure ripple outward. We can influence lives off course. We can wreck trust, and we can dim the reputation of Christ and His kingdom. The title of the message this morning is Integrity in the Workplace, Light Through Character. And the burden of the message is that we would build our lives and witnesses not on the shifting sands of convenience, but on the solid rock of Christ-like integrity, so that when our light is most needed, which is certainly needed today more than ever, it will not fail. What do we mean by integrity? Well, integrity is the quality of being honest, upright, having strong moral principles. It has the idea of doing what is right, even when that is difficult or unpopular. It also means being truthful and reliable and consistent in our actions and words, even when no one else can see what we are doing. And so as Christians, we're called to uphold biblical standards and be an example of integrity in our lives and reflect God's principles. For the first part of the message, I'd like to look at the scriptural basis for integrity. And I invite you to Ephesians 4. As I thought about this message, I read this passage this week, and I was struck by what this passage tells us about integrity. Ephesians 4, I'd like to read verses 17 to 32. Ephesians 4, 17. This I say therefore, and testify in the Lord, that ye henceforth walk not as other Gentiles walked, in the vanity of their mind, having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness, to work all uncleanness with greediness. But ye have not so learned Christ, if so be that ye have heard him, and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that ye put off concerning the former conversation the old man, which is corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that ye put on the new man, which after God is created in righteousness and true holiness. Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Be ye angry and sin not, let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. And grieve not the Holy Spirit of God, whereby ye are sealed unto the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. And be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Now, I know this passage is in the context of church life, but I don't think we do it injustice to apply it to life beyond church life, to our business life, to our social life. And I see in this passage the scriptural basis for integrity in the first number of verses. And so first, integrity begins with a change of master. We're given a description of unconverted man in verses 17 to 19. And it's a bleak picture. The unconverted man calls the Gentiles here, but the unconverted man is controlled by vanity, idolatry, worldliness. He is on his own heart's throne, and he is alienated from God. He's estranged to the life that God requires of him and the life that God approves. And it's not that this man was suddenly coerced into this condition. Notice the progression. Willful ignorance led to blindness, to hardness of heart, to a seared conscience, to being deadened to sin, to being calloused to spiritual things, to being given over to indulge himself in whatever his old man tells him to, and finally, slavery and bondage to the devil. So that unconverted man must have a change of ownership. And so we see that change in verses 20 to 24. It's a complete change. Verse 20 says, you know better. You have had a complete change. Verse 20 could be read, but it reads in the King James, but ye have not so learned Christ. It could be read, but you not so. You have learned Christ. Notice this is a renewing, verse 23. This is not a repair. This is not a patch job. This is a complete personal and decided change of life, habit, and character. It's not covering up a wolfish heart with a sheepskin. It's not putting on some new clothes over top of old clothes. It's a complete new way of life. And I tried to think of a way of illustrating this in a way that we may be able to grasp and maybe the children could even grasp. And so I represented it here on the board as a change of clothing or as a robe. And so we have the old man. The old man that's set on fire by hell. The old man that we discussed from verses 17 to 19. And we are called to put off that old man. The old Adam that's inbred in all of the sons of Adam. It says that we are to put off the old man which is corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. The things that promise us happiness but actually bring us misery. The things that promise us liberty but actually bring us into bondage. I was reading yesterday that after an exposure to nuclear radiation, one of the first things that a person has to do is to change their clothing, a complete change of clothing. And one source I was reading claims that 90% of the radiation can be removed by a simple change of clothing. And so we put off the old man, but that's not enough. We are to put on the new man. The new man. The second Adam has enabled this new man. He's given us the power to become the sons of God. And he has renewed the spirit of our mind. He's renewed our intellect, our will, and our affections. And so the Spirit of God is given to us as a seal on our heart that we are God's. And that Spirit in our hearts renews us, makes us clean, makes us fresh, and continues to draw us to the new man and to God himself. And we can think of this as God and Christ, since they are one. And so then in verses 25 to 32, we have a description of how the new man, the converted man, behaves. And we'll be getting into some more particulars on that in a moment. But ye, not so, don't act like a Gentile, because you have learned Christ. And I thought about it when our brother read from Job, where Job said, I heard of you by the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. This is not just a casual learning of Christ. We are a student of Christ in that we have true knowledge of him, and it's changed our lives. Christ is both the lesson that we are to learn and the teacher that teaches us how to learn. Someone put it this way, it is to know by learning Christ the way to live like him. So integrity begins with a change of master. Secondly, integrity grows with a continual choice of master. Verses 25 to 32 show us that this is an ongoing choice. And the man that we follow, the old man or the new man, determines the course of our life. So we have a daily choice to walk as new men and women, not as what we were by nature. We continue to put off, continue to mortify, put to death, subdue the works of the old man, because even in our converted state, our unconverted carnal nature tends to the rottenness and corruption of this world. And so we put off the shabby, dirty, patched, ragged, unholy rags daily. And we put on, we embrace, we espouse, we cultivate the renewed man. We put on the purple and fine linen of the priests and kings that we are called to be through Jesus Christ. And there's a sense in which putting on the new helps to drive out the old. I don't know if you have much experience with pin oaks, but I remember distinctly growing up, we had a pin oak on our property, and the old leaves would hang on that pin oak all winter long. And they were finally driven off of the tree as the new leaves pushed the next spring. And that happened somewhat in our Christian lives. The more we put on the new, the more the old is put off. So we have a daily choice to be an imitator of Christ, and our faces are toward the light, toward the crown, and it makes a pattern for our private lives, for our home lives, and for our business life. It is our choice to be renewed. It's not enough to be born again and then live the way we want to. We must be fed by that eternal spring of righteousness, or our lives will grow shallow and we will cease to be new and will revert to old. This is a lifelong quest to be an imitator of Christ, and we must continue to allow to compare our habits one by one to what Christ wants for us, and to allow that higher affection, the new man, to dominate and choke out our lower appetites. And so we begin to resemble Christ. His purity, his righteousness, his truth, and his goodness are written on our hearts. As Colossians 3:10 says, we are put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. And that leads us to what verse 24 says, that we are to have righteousness, that's how we relate to each other, and true holiness toward God. It's also a daily choice to embrace a wholeness of heart and life. Integrity, the word, comes from a Latin root, integritas, which literally means wholeness or completeness. It has the idea of being undivided. And so sometimes you hear the expression in the business world, the integrity gap. And the integrity gap, by definition, is a gap between the principles that you say you live by and the patterns that come out in your actual daily life. So if you say, I believe in complete honesty, and yet your business life shows a different pattern, there's a gap in your integrity. And all of us, to a certain degree, have an integrity gap. Because we're not the whole way to eternity yet. And so we still live in the flesh. But our integrity gap is revealed by the little contradictions, the moments where our choices don't match the values that we tell the world we have. And I'm convinced that in my own life, the reason that there is an integrity gap at times is because I'm trying to keep some old clothing underneath my new man. I'm torn. I'm divided. Integrity, wholeness, the integrity gap is narrowed as we move more and more toward Christ, and our life becomes more and more of Christ and less of ourselves and the old man. We practice drawing closer to Christ and putting him on and putting off the old man. We are true, notice, grieve not the Holy Spirit by which ye are sealed. We focus on becoming more and more true to the seal of the Spirit in our lives, the mark that God has put on us, that he owns us and we are responsible to him. And finally, integrity culminates. So integrity begins with a change of master, it grows with a continual choice of master. And thirdly, integrity culminates in a measure of the fullness of Christ our master. If you go back to verses 13 to 15, which is right before what we read, it calls us to come to a unity of faith, to the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man, that's a mature man, unto a measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And again, it's a measure of the stature because we haven't achieved full perfection, but it's an increasing maturity and stability, an increasing integrity, if you please. A diminishing integrity gap and an increasing integrity in Christ. And then finally, if we keep our faces to the light, we will someday be in the eternal likeness of Christ. 1 John 3:2 says, "Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." That's the biblical basis for integrity. Second main point of the message is the everyday challenge of integrity. I started with quite a list of issues that I think are addressed in this passage, but the more I studied it, the more I narrowed it down to three basic challenges of integrity. And you can see these. First, I'll just go across them and then we'll look at them one by one. In verses 25 and 28, we see the challenge of honesty instead of falsehood. In verses 26, 27, 31, and 32, we see the challenge of love instead of selfishness. And in verse 29, we see the challenge of purity instead of corrupt desires. And in all three of those, you can see there's a pull toward the old man and there is a pull toward the new man. And integrity is moving closer and closer to Christ by putting on the new man and putting off the old man. Let's go back and look at these one by one. So first, the challenge of honesty instead of falsehood. What are the principles behind this challenge, or what are the principles to keep in mind as we face this challenge? Well, the heathen and the unconverted have always believed that a profitable lie is better than a hurtful truth. Have you ever been tempted to think that? A profitable lie is better than a hurtful truth. And what Paul is calling us to in Ephesians 4 is the complete opposite. The truth is uncompromisable. The truth must not be compromised, even when it hurts. As Christians, we're called to lie not one to another, seeing that ye have put off the old man with his deeds. We don't lie even for the greatest gain or the greatest benefit that it could bring us. That's a high standard, and we catch ourselves in little ways wanting to fudge the truth. But I'm holding the principle to us that putting on the new man says, I will be 100% honest 100% of the time. I'm fascinated by verse 25. This is a new thought to me as I study. And I know this is in the context of the church, but I think it applies to the larger brotherhood of humanity. Honesty is imperative because verse 25 tells us that we are members one of another. We are in the same society, and that society has to be built on trust. And what happens if members of society lie to each other, and the trust is eroded. Could that be one of the reasons that our society is so polarized today? John Chrysostom said this, "Let not the eye lie to the foot, or the foot to the eye." And he's going back to this thing that we are members one of another. He said, your eye doesn't lie to your foot, and your foot doesn't lie to your eye. He said this, if the eye were to spy a serpent or a wild beast, would it lie to the foot? So if your eye sees a danger, is it going to lie and tell your feet, well, it's okay, just keep right on going, even though there's a poisonous snake ready, coiled ready to strike? No, the eye is going to tell the foot the truth and say, flee. And that is the way we are to be in society, and of course in the church. There's a proverb that says the first step toward greatness is to be honest. And my grandfather used to say, honesty is not only the first step, it is greatness itself. Dwight Eisenhower said this, the supreme quality for a leader is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible. If a leader's associates find him guilty of phoniness, if they find he lacks forthright integrity, he will fail. His teachings and actions must square with each other. And if that's true for leaders in society and leaders in politics, how much truer is it for Christians, or how much more essential is it for Christians? Sometimes we cringe when someone has a bad reputation, but let's remember that the reputation is only the shadow that the character casts. And so the root issue is, again, back to what is at the heart and what is being put on and put off. Honesty builds confidence. The world wants to know where we stand, even if they don't agree with us. It enables our usefulness and it enhances our Christian testimony. Remember, we're to be that beacon of light. And one of the primary ways that we do that on a daily basis is to be honest in our business. Compromising on truth brings us, the church, down to the level of the world. We have nothing to offer them if we operate by the same principles. Psalm 15:2 asks, who shall ascend into thy holy hill? Who shall stand? Who shall be a citizen of Zion, so to speak? And verse 2 says, he that speaketh the truth in his heart, he whose heart is completely committed to the truth of the new man. I'm also fascinated by the principle in verse 28. One of the most Christ-like motives to work and to work honestly is to have to share. You know, paganism, heathenism, unconverted people would rob others of what is rightfully theirs and take it for themselves. So you have something that's rightfully yours. The unconverted say, I want it, I'll take it, even though it's yours. Christianity is the exact reverse. Christianity leads us to give to others what is rightfully ours. And that is the heart of Christ. Think about the Christ example of what he gave for us. In 1991, Americans were polled as to what they would do for $10 million. And I was horrified to read the results. 25% of them would abandon their families for $10 million. 25% would abandon their church. 16% would leave their spouse for $10 million. And 7% of Americans admitted that they would kill a stranger for $10 million. But the Christian says, I wouldn't do any of those things for $10 million. Now, work for $10 million? Yes, although that's not my goal. My goal is to work to meet my needs and to give. What are some challenges that we face in the area of honesty instead of falsehood? And I struggle to put these into a comprehensible order, so it may seem a bit like a laundry list, but they were things that came to my mind as I read these verses. We face the challenge of truthfulness in speech. And truthfulness in speech begins with truthfulness in conversation, from the very trivial things to the very serious things. If we find ourselves exaggerating and telling tall tales, It is unlikely that if we cannot be honest in the unguarded moments, that we will stand in the stress of temptation. We need to be careful not to leave a wrong impression. Be careful not to boast. Be careful not to take credit for what others have done. If we say that we are selling something for under the cost we paid for it, it had better be true. I worked with a man years ago who had worked at a very common retailer, and he claimed that before the retailer put things on sale, it would go through and raise the price so that it could then put it on sale and for the exact price that it had been before. That is not an integrity, not an honest way to do it, and it is not the track of integrity. We dare not take advantage of any man's ignorance or unskillfulness. If you know your business and somebody comes into your business not knowing how it works, you can very easily bamboozle them with a lot of fancy language and jargon. I face this when I answer the phone and I'm talking to someone who is very technologically impaired, and we're talking about websites and advertising online. I could very easily sell them way more than what they ever need, but I dare not. We need to use openness and plainness in our selling and in our way we present our business. No craftiness. I struggle with this when we have the pressure to upsell. Well, do they need to be upsold? If they only need a basic product, why would I put the bells and whistles on it simply to run the price up? To me, that's a compromise of my integrity. We keep our promises. We don't promise what we know we can't keep. We don't promise to have it done on Monday if we know that it's going to be Wednesday. We overpromise and underdeliver, because as Psalm 15, verse 4 says, he that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not is worthy to be a citizen of Zion. And we remember that Ecclesiastes 5, verse 5 says that it's better that we shouldn't vow or promise than that we should promise or vow and not pay it. We take responsibility for our debts. I've always been fascinated by the fact that if a starving man on the street steals a $50 coat, we label him a thief, and he may even spend time in jail. But if a businessman siphons $50,000 off of a business before declaring bankruptcy to escape his debt, we're tempted to say, oh, he's pretty shrewd. He's a good businessman. Is it any different? Henry Heinz, might recognize that name, was a German immigrant boy, helped support his family by raising vegetables. And fresh out of college and fresh from the marriage altar, he started his own business selling horseradish. In 1875, there was a national financial collapse that drove his young company into bankruptcy. Now, despite the fact that bankruptcy freed him legally from his debts, Henry Heinz regarded each of those debts as a personal moral obligation, and he worked and personally paid back every penny of those debts. Why? Because he was a Christian. And he went on to found the H.J. Heinz Company with its 57 varieties that's still around today. We need to be careful in our advertising, not to indicate that our product is so much better than the competitor's product, that we not oversell it, that we focus on what is the realistic expectation that my product can do to meet the needs of my customers. We don't manipulate our customers or stir up covetousness. The one writing model that we follow in marketing is advocates using language like, you deserve so-and-so, and I refuse to use that word. Because what do we deserve? I don't believe we should stir up the covetousness of, you deserve this in your life. We need to be very careful to remember that dishonesty in trade or deceit in business is the same as stealing. Let him that steal no more. I read the story of Theodore Roosevelt when he was a rancher in the West for a number of years before he was president. He and one of his cowpokes were out one day on the open range, and they lassoed a maverick steer. And so they were going to brand this steer, and according to the laws of the range, whoever's land the steer was found on owned the steer. Well, they happened to be on the neighbor's land. A neighbor was Gregor Lang. So as they were heating up the branding iron, Theodore Roosevelt looked at his cowboy and he said, "Hey, that should be Lang's brand. We found it on his land, it's his." "No, that's all right," the cowboy said. And Theodore Roosevelt said, "But you've got my brand there." "That's right." And Theodore Roosevelt said, "Drop that iron and get back to the ranch and get out of here. I don't need you anymore. A man that will steal for me will steal from me. We dare not sell altered material." Back in the old days, it was water in the milk. "We dare not water down our product. If we say that there are Amish-made goods, they'd better be. If we say that they're 100% Himalayan yak, they'd better be. We dare not overestimate what we sell or underestimate what we buy and then brag about it, whether it's to gain a customer, ruin a competitor, or simply to gain money. The love of money is the root of all evil and the root of a lot of loss of integrity. We all like good measure, but are we willing to give it? We need to give good measure, heaped up, running over. We will not lose in the end. Dishonesty is not a trick of the trade. It is a trick of the devil. I know of a Mennonite company that invented serial numbers of non-existent equipment to persuade investors that they had more collateral than what they did so that the investors would give them more money. We dare not fudge our financial reports or exploit shady tax loopholes. And as consumers, we need to guard against dishonesty. You ever been tempted? The store has a price match guarantee. You could really manipulate that. But if we go into a store and we say, "What price is your flashlight?" and they say $5, we dare not say, "Oh, I can get that for $4 at Lowe's," unless we can. We dare not manipulate them into a lower price. What happens if we're given too much change? What happens if we're not charged for an item? Are we willing to go back and make it right? Women too, as wives and mothers, have tremendous influence and must be models of virtue to their children. Because remember, when all of the buyable and all of the bribable things of earth have wasted away, the men and women of integrity will stand in everlasting remembrance. And may we never hear in the workplace, "It's just a little lie," or "No one will ever know," or "I know it's unfair, but I'm going to take advantage anyway," or "I'll say whatever it takes to get ahead." The first Governor General of Australia liked to talk about a 300-year-old ledger that he had inherited from one of his ancestors who owned a business in Scotland. And when he opened that book for the first time, he noticed that inside the cover was inscribed a prayer that I believe should be the prayer of each of us as we face the challenge of the integrity of honesty. His ancestor had written this inside the ledger: "O Lord, keep me and this book honest." Secondly, love instead of selfishness. Verses 26, 27, 31, 32, we are told not to be angry. We're told to let bitterness and wrath and everything associated with them depart and be kind. And so what are the principles? Well, in the stress of business life, we dare not become angry at anything other than sin and jealousy for God's glory. We can't give room or place or opportunity for the devil to take the exasperations and the irritations of life and make them an occasion to sin. If we cherish anger in our heart, we will very quickly learn that it is easy to sin in anger and it is very hard to be angry without sinning. Anger is like a bee that stings someone and loses its own life in the process. We can cause some momentary pain to someone who exasperates us with a flash of anger, but it hurts us more than it hurts them. Another principle is to put ourselves in the place and the circumstances of every man and woman to whom we relate. The golden rule: is it reasonable in your own mind? Are you set on it? and have you come up with practical ways to exhibit the golden rule in your business life. We're responsible for the influence that we have on each other. Verses 31 and 32, I think, hold this out very clear to us, that every action that we exhibit toward someone must come from the well of love and goodwill in our hearts. We put away the resentment. We put away the displeasure. We put away threatening. And this is very serious, because what is our goal? Our goal is to be a beacon to bring men to Jesus Christ. And if we cannot win them by love, it is very doubtful that we will win them by any other means. And if we do not show love to them on a daily work relationship, we can't profess our love on a personal relationship. Jesus said, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, because you have love one for another." And so every impression that we leave through business and in the workplace is either going to be credited to our account as Christians or detracted from our account. So what are the challenges that we face? Well, we face the challenge of not harboring resentment and keeping it fermenting in our hearts and minds. Do you ever feel this in a workplace, a tension going on between employees or between employees and employer? If we ferment, allow something to foment and ferment in our minds, it's going to lead to hatred and revenge. A Latin proverb says, "He who goes to bed angry has the devil for a bedfellow." And that's very true. We need to be careful to receive and treat the public kindly and sincerely. Seek honestly and sincerely to serve and please them, because the public will form an opinion as to the genuineness of your Christianity by how you treat them. Our words are to edify, verse 29, to build each other up. And that is within the church as well as without the church. It should bring some wisdom. It should bring some conviction. It should improve the hearts and minds of even society people that we relate to. And our neighbors are watching. Years ago, I heard the story, my grandfather told the story of a woman who lived next to a Mennonite man. She was not a Christian, but at least she wasn't a hypocrite. And her testimony of that neighbor was, "He lives like a heathen through the week." Unfortunately, he taught Sunday school on Sunday morning, but she wasn't dumb. She could see through it. Years ago, my father was in a business situation, and the man he was relating to was very hesitant to work with him because he had mistakenly heard that a distant relative was a close relative, and he thought my dad was going to be the same unreasonable, nasty person as his relative. Well, when he found out that my father was not closely related, he was much relieved and the stress went out of the situation. Another challenge is how we collect outstanding bills. I believe it's okay to ask for outstanding bills to be paid, but not to issue threats or force. It's probably wise to just steer as clear as we can of the whole credit business. Years ago, I worked at a company who had an outstanding bill, and they decided, after asking for it several times, to turn it over to a collection agency. And that was like throwing a handful of gunpowder onto a fire. They lost not only a customer, but they also lost their testimony. We face the challenge or the possibility of marring our integrity as consumers by constantly trying to lower a marked price. Now, I believe that it's okay to shop prices and to go somewhere else to buy. You don't have to go into the first store and pay a price that's higher than somewhere else. But let's be careful of haggling and twisting and being unreasonable. Every business has to make a reasonable profit. Years ago, I heard of a Mennonite and the implement dealer joked that they tossed a coin when that man came through the door to see who had to deal with him that day, because they knew that he was going to pinch the pennies till Lincoln hollered. Another Mennonite brother I heard of went back and forth between two local lawnmower dealerships, pitting them against each other until he had them both jewed down to the very, very rock bottom price. And then he went across the state line to the one that was in the state with the 1% less sales tax and bought from them. What will they think of our God if we're known as a hard-nosed skinflint. We dare not be inconsiderate, selfish, contemptuous, unforgiving to those we work with, or how will we influence them to Christ? We are called to love the hard to love those who hurt us. We're faced with the challenge of being too busy to really talk to and relate to and develop a relationship with those whom we are supposedly winning to Christ. Do we have time from our work? Can we take time from our work to show interest in their lives and discuss their soul's needs and build a relationship with them? And employers, I would just throw this out. Do your employees have your blessing to do so on the clock? Or are you putting them in a position where they feel like they cannot witness without clocking out first? Our goal must be to leave customers satisfied and feeling as though we treated them as a Christian should. And that is, our goal should be the mutual advantage of both parties involved in a transaction. I read of a Mennonite man who was looking for a particular tool, knew the tool cost $500. He decided he would only spend $300. That was his max budget. So he started to look around for a used tool. And lo and behold, he found one at a garage sale. Looked immaculate, barely used. The price tag on it was $35. What a wonderful opportunity. But then he stopped and thought. He knew two things. Number one, he knew that the woman who was having the garage sale had recently lost her husband, and she was obviously selling his tools. And secondly, he knew what the tool was worth. And so what should he do? Should he pay what she was asking? She was going to be happy. He was going to be happy. He ended up telling her that he was willing to give $300 for the tool. And she was shocked. And by the way, the only way the story got out was because she told it. He didn't. And what led him to reveal the true value of the tool? Well, it was that desire for a mutual satisfaction. He wasn't out for what he could get. His heart wasn't back here in the old man. His heart was love and mutual blessing in the transaction. And that desire for mutual satisfaction may cost us a lot of money if we run into an unreasonable customer. But I would personally rather lie down and have footprints all across my back from customers walking over me than to feel one stripe on my back in the judgment for standing my ground in an unchristlike way. We may not seek the advantage by oppressing or injuring others. And I think this particularly comes to employers. Are we as good to our employees and customers as we are to ourselves, or do we see them as money-making pawns? You see, wages and rent and interest are not mere money matters. They affect people's livelihoods and dreams. They affect their welfare and their spirituality. A little bit more on employees and employers. If you turn over to Ephesians 6, verses 5 to 9 gives us some direct admonition to masters and servants, which I believe in our day and age is applied to employees and employers. And I'm not going to take the time to read those verses, but I challenge you to read them on your own. But I believe the verses tell us that employers and employees are to regard each other's welfare and interest and fulfill their part of the contract. The employers are to give fair wages and opportunities, and the employees are to give the rightful respect and service due. Because the employee, the servant, in Ephesians 6, realizes that he's serving God rather than just serving man. And he's doing it in singleness of heart. He's not just pretending obedience while he's disobeying. He has his eye on Jesus Christ. And he's really principally serving his master in heaven. He's not a man pleaser. And so he's rendering full value for the pay that he's receiving. He's diligent. Whatever his hand finds to do, he is doing it. Think of Joseph as the epitome of an employee full of integrity. Employees who are serving Christ primarily flee carelessness and half-heartedness. Michelangelo painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel with very detailed art frescoes depicting Bible scenes, and he spent hours lying on his back getting every detail just right. And a friend said to him, "Why are you putting so much effort into something that is way up there? Nobody's ever going to be able to see the detail." The friend said, "Who will notice whether it's perfect or not?" And Michelangelo said, "I will." I read of a mason whose apprentice said he put his conscience into every stone he laid. On the other hand, the employer is not an autocrat. He is not the boss. He has a master in heaven to whom he will answer. And so Ephesians 6 tells us that masters are to be the same as servants. They are to have the same heart for the servant. They're to have the same heart for the employee as they want the employee to have for them. Because your master is in heaven. Both your master and their master is in heaven, that verse could read. And so when we're tempted to grind down or wear down or scold or threaten an employee, remember that their cry will come to their master, who is also your master. So the third area of challenge that we face, and this one's a short one, verse 29, we're called, back in Ephesians 4, 29, we're called to let no corrupt communication proceed out of our mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying. Purity instead of corrupt desires. I believe that purity is essential because it safeguards one of humans, mankind's strongest tendencies and strongest passions. And with the strongest passions and tendencies that we have, the stronger the inclination to go astray. And so we must protect them. We dare not trifle with these old passions that we have put off, that are dormant. They're still there, they're still sensitive, and we dare not trifle with them. To trifle with them is to place ourselves on the path of succumbing to them. And so we must guard our thoughts and guard our eyes and guard our spirits to avoid inappropriate social relationships or impurity, which do more to wreck families and wreck our integrity than just about any other sin will. And so we face challenges of our associates and our choice of appearance. The way we appear is going to either identify us as one of the world, ready to enter right into their way of life, or it's going to identify us as someone different. It's either going to break down the barrier, the reserve, or it's going to establish the boundary. And so we need to be very careful with social intimacy, mixed social intimacy without a spouse or an accountability partner. Former Vice President Mike Pence refused to meet with another woman other than his wife alone. And he was mocked in the media for it. And I'm not holding him up as an example for us today, other than I believe in that case, he was very wise. We must guard against sharing with a member of the opposite gender on an emotional level. And if we find ourselves enjoying or looking forward to the company of someone the opposite gender, it must be a red flag to us. 1 Thessalonians 5:22 calls us to abstain from all appearance of evil. And we're called to put off filthy talking and jesting because they will wear away at the foundation of purity. The idle joke, the idle talk, the offhand comment, the irreverent word may never be forgotten by the person that hears us, and it may impact their spiritual life. We need to be careful not to do work for or work in environments that undermine our purity. I heard recently of a man who was called to do some service work in a room in which there were indecent pictures on display. And he said, "I'll come and do the work when the pictures are taken down." And they were taken down, and then he went and did the work. We must draw clear lines. And just because, gentlemen, just because ladies aren't present doesn't mean that it's time to break out the shady jokes. I read an example of an American general who was warming himself by a campfire, and a private, young private soldier came up to the campfire, and he looked around, and he said, "Oh, I see no ladies are present." He said, "That's good, because I've got a really juicy story to tell you." He said, "I'm really glad there aren't any ladies present." And the general looked at him and he said, "No, there are gentlemen present." Ted Engstrom said this: "The world needs men and women who cannot be bought, whose word is their bond, who put character above wealth, who are larger than their vocations, who will not lose their individuality in a crowd. The world needs men and women who will be as honest in the small things as in the great things, who will make no compromise with wrong, whose ambitions are not confined to their own selfish desires. The world needs men and women who will not say they do it because everybody else does it, who do not believe that shrewdness, cunning, and hard-headedness are the best qualities for winning success, who are not ashamed or afraid to stand for truth when it is unpopular. The world needs men and women who say no with emphasis, although the rest of the world says yes. The world needs such men and women, and God commands us to be those men and women of integrity, and He will enable us to be them." Let's kneel for prayer.